Hello and welcome to the Deep Dive. I'm Sam McGee, your guide for today's exploration.
And I'm Taylor Ladis, ready to help us connect the dots on some of the most compelling tech news of the day.
Today, we're taking a deep dive into the Register RSS Feeds Morning Edition for Wednesday, August 20th, 2025.
Right.
This is a truly rich collection of sources, and our mission, as always, is to extract the most important nuggets of knowledge and insight, offering you that shortcut to being truly well-informed. Mm-hmm. We're going to cover everything from surprising and, frankly, concerning developments in AI pricing to revelations about space technology and crucial cybersecurity alerts impacting everything from major corporations to open source tools.
Lots to unpack there.
Definitely. Okay, let's unpack all this and get started.
So to kick things off, we're diving straight into the rapidly evolving world of AI tools and maybe more specifically, the ethical and financial considerations that are, well, quite frankly, struggling to keep pace with the technology itself.
That's certainly the case, yeah. And nowhere is that more evident right now than with AWS and their new AI-driven coding tool, Kiro. It's been quite the roller coaster ride for developers, hasn't it?
Oh, absolutely.
Starting with what seems like a genuinely reasonable and competitive pricing structure just last month?
Exactly. Kiro was introduced as a new AI coding assistant built as a fork of CodeOSS, which is, you know, the open source foundation for Visual Studio Code.
Right.
The initial pitch was that it offered this unique approach to AI coding assistance, driven by specific tasks and user requirements. And initially, its pricing was designed to be incredibly accessible, almost too good to be true, really.
It really was. They announced a free tier that gave you 50 interactions per month, which is, you know, done a decent for trying it out.
Mm-hmm. Great taste.
Then you had a pro plan at $19 for 1,000 interactions,
yeah,
and a pro plus tier at $39 for 3,000 interactions. Mm-hmm. And if you somehow blew through those, additional interactions were a mere 4 cents each.
Mm-hmm.
From a developer's perspective, that sounded like a transparent and pretty good deal, didn't it?
Yeah.
Something you could actually budget for.
It absolutely did. And what happened next was, well, entirely predictable. Kiro proved to be immediately popular.
So popular.
So popular, in fact, that Amazon swiftly moved to introduce a waitlist. And almost immediately after that, those initial very transparent pricing details simply vanished from their website.
Uh-oh.
Red flag.
Exactly. That's usually the first subtle hint that changes are coming, and they're probably not going to be in the user's favor.
And boy, were they right. Just last week, the new revised pricing was officially announced, and as many early users quickly discovered, it was far, far less generous.
Yeah.
Antonio Ribeiro, who's an open source PHP and Laravel engineer, didn't hold back his punches, openly calling it a wallet-wrecking tragedy.
Strong words.
That's strong language, but it definitely reflects the sentiment out there.
It does. The new structure introduced two distinct types of Kiro AI requests, which immediately added a layer of complexity, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You have spec requests, which are specifically for task-driven operations, like generating code based on a prompt. Then there are vibe requests, which are for more general chat responses, conversational elements.
Okay.
The problem is, the act of executing a subtask now consumes at least one spec request plus a vibe request, purely for what they call coordination.
Ah, okay. So not just one interaction then.
Not at all. And this is where Nathan Peck's earlier assurances, he's an AWS developer advocate, that a single interaction might run for 3 to 5 minutes of Kiro iterating away on writing code, really began to unravel.
Right.
AWS explicitly stated they can consume more requests based on complexity, directly contradicting that earlier, much simpler promise.
So if you're a developer picturing your AI assistant diligently humming away on a complex problem, what you're actually learning is that it might be quietly draining your budget much faster than you can even hit cancel.
Pretty much, yeah.
And the new tiers truly reflect this. The free tier now only gives you 50 vibe requests and, crucially, zero spec requests.
Yeah, zero. None of the useful stuff, essentially.
Exactly. Then you jump to the pro plan at $20, which gets you 225 vibe and 125 spec requests. Pro Plus is $40 for 450 vibe and 250 spec. And then there's the power tier, which is a whopping $200 for 2,250 vibe and 1,250 spec requests.
Wow.
But here's the real kicker and what infuriated so many people. While additional vibe requests are still 4 cents, additional spec requests now cost 5 times more at 20 cents each.
It's 20 cents.
That's an astronomical jump for the most useful type of interaction.
That exponential cost increase for spec requests had immediate and, well, painful real-world implications, especially for independent developers and those working on open source projects.
You bet.
Antonio Ribeiro, in his detailed breakdown, estimated that for someone doing light coding, they'd be looking at costs of around $550 per month.
$550.
Yeah. And for a full-time coding workload, that could skyrocket to $1,950 per month.
Just incredible.
As an open source developer, he felt this revised pricing was an outright kick in the shins. He also pointed out a frustrating usability issue. Vibe requests felt largely useless, with the AI agent constantly nagging him to switch to spec requests, claiming his conversational chats were too complex for the Vibe tier.
So constantly pushing you towards the more expensive option.
Exactly. It felt like a constant push.
And this wasn't an isolated incident, right? Yep. This frustration was widespread.
Oh, definitely not. There was widespread frustration exploding across GitHub forums and within the Kiro Discord community. Developers were reporting that their Pro Plus monthly limits were being completely consumed within 15 minutes of usage in a single chat session.
15 minutes. 15 minutes. Imagine paying $40 for a month of service and having it vanish before your coffee gets cold.
Yeah.
One user specifically noted that when they made what they considered one request to the AI, Kiro would, in practice, consume 4 to 6 Vibe requests, never just the single interaction that was implied.
So completely opaque. Totally. This utter opacity and shockingly rapid consumption were huge points of contention, fueling a massive backlash online.
And when you consider the competitive landscape Kiro entered, its initial attractive pricing was clearly an attempt to lure users away from established alternatives, right?
Absolutely. Amazon Q, for instance, offers 3,000 requests for $40, a direct contrast to Kiro's new tiers. Trey, another competitor, boasts unlimited requests, though it can be slow sometimes. And Windsurf is widely described as way more affordable for experimenting.
So Kiro's new model basically priced it out of that initial advantage.
It really seemed that way. It seemed to price it right out of that competitive advantage it initially sought to carve out.
But then here's where the narrative takes a surprising, though maybe not entirely unprecedented, turn.
Mm-hmm.
Just as this entire story was breaking and developer outrage was peaking, AWS came forward with an update. They flagged what they called a pricing bug.
A bug.
Openly admitting that some tasks were inaccurately consuming multiple requests, which caused users to burn through their precious limits much faster than expected.
Ah, so an explanation, sort of.
An explanation. They promised a fix would be rolled out in a couple of days.
Mm-hmm.
And crucially, they committed to resetting the limits for all affected users. Even better, they stated they would not charge anyone for the month of August, and those who had already been charged would receive full refunds.
Okay, well, that's actually pretty good damage control, you have to admit.
It is. Credit where it's due for the response.
Yeah. But this admission and the subsequent swift resolution, while certainly a positive step in rectifying a major error, still highlights a significant underlying risk in the burgeoning world of AI services. The potential for unexpected and, frankly, astronomical cost escalation.
Absolutely.
It really underscores the immense challenges companies face in accurately estimating and then transparently pricing the actual resource consumption of complex AI operations.
Even the giants struggle.
Exactly. Even a tech giant like AWS, with all its expertise, can clearly misjudge the economics and technical intricacies of these new models in a real-world environment. For you, the user or the business considering adopting AI tools, this should serve as a stark reminder. Approach new AI services with extreme caution regarding their cost models, no matter how enticing they initially appear.
Don't trust the initial sticker price.
Pretty much. Always ask the hard questions about how consumption is measured and what edge cases might trigger unexpected billing.
That's a critical observation. And moving on from the wallet wrecking, let's talk about something equally, if not more, unsettling.
Yeah.
The unseen price of AI convenience, especially when it comes to fundamental issues like privacy and data retention.
Right. This is where user assumptions often collide head-on with corporate reality, sometimes quite painfully.
Yeah, tell me about it. There was a recent wave of shock among OpenAI ChatGPT users when they quite unexpectedly discovered that their private searches were somehow appearing in Google search results.
Oh, wow. How did that happen?
Well, the irony here, as the source pointed out, is that OpenAI had actually stated this possibility right within their share option, specifically noting, make this chat discoverable and shown in web searches in that smaller, often overlooked text.
Ah, the classic fine print problem.
It's a classic, almost archetypal case of users simply not reading those lengthy end user license agreements or privacy policies. We all do it.
Guilty as charged.
It really is, isn't it?
Yeah.
It goes back to that old adage, never ascribe to malice what can be explained by negligence. OpenAI's chief information security officer, Dane Stuckey, quickly responded to the outcry by removing the share option altogether.
Okay, so they pulled it.
Pulled it. He openly acknowledged that the feature introduced too many opportunities for folks to accidentally share things they didn't intend to.
Mm-hmm.
They're also actively working to remove any of that inadvertently indexed content from search engines. So the public discoverability issue is being addressed, and that's a good step.
Okay.
But is the underlying problem truly solved? Not entirely.
Okay, what's the catch?
This is what's truly fascinating here as a crucial distinction. While the public sharing issue is being rectified, a federal court order in an ongoing copyright lawsuit has forced OpenAI to preserve all user conversations from ChatGPT on its consumer-facing tiers.
All of them, even deleted ones.
All of them. And this isn't just about standard chats. This mandate includes even temporary chat sessions, which were previously touted as being automatically erased after use.
Wow. So temporary isn't temporary at all in this context.
Not in the eyes of the court, no.
Yeah.
So in effect, for the purposes of this legal battle, nothing you say to ChatGPT is truly temporary. Even if you think you've deleted a query or used a temporary mode, it's still being stored and retained by OpenAI, potentially indefinitely for legal purposes.
That changes the perception quite a bit.
Doesn't it? And this data retention issue isn't unique to OpenAI. It actually points to a broader industry trend among AI providers.
Like who?
Take Google Gemini, for example. They've begun rolling out a memory feature that automatically remembers key details from past chats to personalize subsequent responses.
Ah, for convenience.
Exactly. So if you've previously asked about dog breeds and mentioned owning a Shih Tzu, Gemini will recall that detail and tailor its future dog treat recommendations accordingly.
Okay, I can see the upside there.
Sure. And Anthropic's Claude, another major AI model, has also quietly added a similar memory feature, indicating this is becoming a standard for convenience.
Right. But the personal risk here is quite profound, isn't it?
Yeah.
And it extends far beyond just dog treats.
Absolutely.
While these features are undoubtedly designed for convenience and personalization, they also create a permanent, potentially unerasable AI record of all your queries, regardless of their sensitivity.
Imagine for a moment, hypothetically asking an AI about how to make 3D printed gun parts, or discussing a highly sensitive medical condition, or exploring controversial political views.
Yeah.
That query could now become part of a permanently retained AI data set, accessible in ways you might never have intended. While Google's feature can be disabled, past user behavior, like with OpenAI's share option, suggests many users simply won't take that extra step to opt out, prioritizing convenience over privacy.
It's the path of least resistance, usually.
It often is. And this pervasive data retention isn't limited just to conversational chatbots. It extends to other AI-driven services, as powerfully highlighted by the ongoing legal battle against Otter.ai, a popular voice transcription service.
Ah, yes, Otter. What's the issue there?
The core complaint in this class action lawsuit is that Otter NoteTaker, their flagship product, records and transcribes meetings, not just for its account holders, but for AI training purposes.
Okay, that sounds potentially problematic.
And here's the critical point. It records all participants in a meeting, including guests who don't have Otter accounts, without their explicit individual consent.
Oh, that's the key. Without consent from everyone recorded.
Precisely.
The lawsuit specifically alleges that Otter.ai obtains significant financial benefits from this practice of using unconsented recordings for AI training, and that it directly violates multiple privacy laws, including the Electronic Communications Privacy Act and various California state laws.
And Otter's defense.
Otter's anticipated defense is that its account holders have the responsibility to inform guests about the recording, essentially attempting to shift the legal burden onto the user.
Passing the buck, basically.
You could say that. However, the plaintiffs are countering that Otter is fundamentally outsourcing its legal obligations rather than seeking direct consent from the specific individuals whose voices are being recorded, transcribed, and then used to train AI models. This raises a fundamental challenge about who bears the responsibility for data privacy in an AI-driven world.
This raises a truly important question for all of us, really. In our relentless pursuit of AI-driven convenience and efficiency across every aspect of our lives, how much personal data are we unknowingly or perhaps uncaringly surrendering? What are the profound long-term legal and ethical ramifications of AI models being trained on vast, ever-growing data sets that potentially include unconsented user data? It's a trade-off we might not fully grasp the consequences of, until it's far too late, when that data becomes part of a permanent, unerasable record.
Yeah, it's a creeping expansion. From the ethical quandaries of AI and data privacy, let's pivot to a different kind of challenge. The very practical and sometimes shockingly basic security flaws that continue to plague even major organizations.
It really underscores that even with the most advanced AI on the horizon, the fundamental human element in cybersecurity remains a critical, often vulnerable link.
Absolutely.
You are absolutely not kidding. Let's talk about McDonald's of all places.
McDonald's, okay.
A hacker known as Bob the Hacker uncovered what can only be described as rotten security within the fast food giant's corporate systems. And the initial reporting issues were a huge red flag from the start. She actually had to resort to finding McDonald's security staff on LinkedIn and contacting them directly just to get them to pay attention to critical vulnerabilities.
Wow, that's not how vulnerability disclosure is supposed to work.
Not at all. It speaks volumes about a potentially disconnected security posture. She found alarmingly scant security measures in their feel-good design hub, which is basically a repository of marketing materials for staff across 120 countries.
Okay.
Even after she alerted them to the issues, it took McDonald's a staggering 3 months to implement a fix, and that fix itself was barely a Band-Aid. Anyone could still create an account on this internal hub simply by changing the word login to register in the URL.
Seriously, just change the URL.
Just change the URL. And then, to make matters worse, their passwords were sent to them in plain text in 2025.
Plain text passwords. Wow. I mean, just wow.
Plain text passwords for a global corporation of McDonald's size. It genuinely boggles the mind. She also discovered that McDonald's use of Algolia, which is a search as a service provider, was improperly configured and exposed the names and email addresses of anyone who had ever requested access to the site.
Okay, so data leakage too.
But it actually gets even worse. Through a deeply flawed OF implementation, low-level crew members could unexpectedly gain access to executive portals in what she described as secret corporate documents, ultimately revealing every single employee's email address from the CEO right down to individual store managers.
Oh my goodness, that's a goldmine for phishers.
An absolute treasure trove for future phishing attacks.
What's particularly disturbing about this situation, beyond the sheer scale of the vulnerabilities, is the anecdote Bob the Hacker shared about a friend who helped her expose these flaws.
Yeah.
That friend was later fired for security concerns from corporate, and Bob the Hacker herself had no idea how McDonald's managed to identify them.
That's chilling. Potential retaliation for disclosure.
It's a chilling example of potential retaliation against responsible disclosure, which actively discourages ethical hackers from coming forward. To add insult to injury, McDonald's still lacks a security.txt file, which is a common industry standard for facilitating responsible vulnerability disclosure.
Still, after all this.
Still. And let's not forget a recent baffling incident where their job applicant AI chatbot, Olivia, was easily hacked with an admin password of 123456.
Oh, come on.
123456.
123456.
Yeah.
These aren't advanced exploits. These are fundamental security failures at multiple levels.
It just makes you wonder about the basic hygiene, doesn't it? And it's not just major corporations with these issues. Even open source AI tools can have their moments of vulnerability.
True.
There was a recently patched flaw in a Llama desktop, which is an AI model runner, that allowed for what are called drive-by attacks from malicious websites.
Okay, drive-by attacks. How did that work?
Well, this particular vulnerability in a Llama desktop was quite serious, as it could potentially allow attackers to remotely target PCs, spy on local AI-driven chats, and even control the AI models by serving poisoned models that would then run on the user's machine.
Right, that sounds pretty bad.
Thankfully, Chris Moberly of GitLab, a security researcher, discovered and reported the flaw quickly, and the Llama team patched it within hours, which is commendable.
Good response time. Very good. But Moberly noted that exploitation would have been trivial in the wild, even describing it as something a large language model could write pretty easily.
Okay, so easily weaponized.
And the technical bypass Moberly discovered was quite clever, wasn't it?
Yeah.
He managed to trick the Llama desktop application into treating a specific settings-changing POS request as simple by deliberately removing the content type header from it.
Ah, messing with the headers.
Exactly. For our listeners, what's the significance of that? What does skipping standard cores pre-flight checks actually allow an attacker to do?
Right. So that's a crucial detail that highlights a common web security pattern. CORS, or cross-origin resource sharing, pre-flight checks, are essentially a security handshake that modern web browsers and applications use.
Okay.
Before sending a potentially complex or risky request to a server, for example, a request that might modify data or use custom headers, the browser first sends a small pre-flight request to ask the server for permission. It's like knocking on the door and asking, are you ready to receive this kind of request?
Gotcha. A permissions check.
Exactly. By stripping that content type header, Moberly essentially made the request look simple and harmless to Alama, allowing it to bypass that crucial security gate entirely. It's a bit like sneaking past a bouncer at a club by pretending you're just delivering a pizza, when in fact you're planning something entirely different once inside.
Nice analogy.
Once that initial bypass was achieved, it opened the door for a two-stage exploit. First, port scanning for the GI's randomly assigned port, and then sending a fake request to configure a malicious remote server to intercept or modify the user's AI chats.
Wow. What's fascinating here is the sheer range of vulnerabilities we're witnessing, from incredibly basic 123456 passwords and the absurdity of plain text emails to more sophisticated protocol bypasses like the one discovered in Alama.
It really runs the gamut.
It truly underscores that even with the most advanced AI and cutting-edge technology, fundamental human error and oversight in basic security practices remain alarmingly significant risks. And it genuinely raises the question of how quickly we can truly adapt our security posture as new technologies introduce entirely new and complex attack vectors, sometimes while old, simple ones still persist.
It's a constant race. Shifting gears from security at the human and software level, let's talk about the massive infrastructure and innovation challenges that are increasingly shaping the tech world, particularly the absolutely insatiable demand for data centers fueled by the AI boom.
It's a critical issue, and the data paints a pretty stark picture, doesn't it?
It really does.
The latest North America Data Center report from JLL reveals a truly stark reality. Colocation capacity has plummeted to a record low of just 2.3% vacancy.
2.3%, that's incredibly low.
It's a dramatic drop from 9.8% in 2020. This indicates an incredibly tight market, with most of the construction pipeline already pre-leased by hungry clients.
And it's not just a minor hiccup in the market, is it? The report estimates a staggering $1 trillion will be needed in new data center builds by 2030 just to keep up with current and projected demand.
$1 trillion. Just to keep pace.
It's a huge number. This isn't just a number. It's explicitly called a key break on growth for the entire tech industry, indicating that compute capacity itself could become the limiting factor for innovation.
Compounding that challenge, and perhaps even more critically, is the issue of power.
Ah, the power problem. Always the power problem.
The average wait time for a grid connection for a new data center in North America is now 4 years.
4 years, just to plug it in.
4 years just to get electricity.
Yeah.
Utilities are also demanding hard deposits much earlier in the process, which strains budgets. And U.S. commercial electricity rates have increased by over 20% in recent years, primarily due to aging infrastructure and this record-breaking demand.
Yeah.
Even though the JLL report doesn't explicitly mention AI, its influence on this frenzied demand is unmistakably clear, with hyperscalers snapping up capacity, often pre-leasing it years in advance, effectively cornering the market.
And this isn't just a North American problem either, right? Europe's facing similar issues.
Exactly. Europe, for instance, saw demand for data center capacity significantly outstrip supply in 2023, and they're facing similar constraints on power and available land for development.
So where is all this desperately needed capacity actually being added?
Good question. Northern Virginia, Dallas, and Atlanta have seen the largest increases in sheer capacity since 2020, while places like Columbus and Austin, San Antonio have quadrupled their capacity in percentage terms, albeit from a smaller baseline. So you see these emerging hubs popping up.
Right, as the traditional ones get saturated.
Precisely. It's no wonder, then, that data centers have become what real estate analysts are calling a most favored real estate asset class for investors.
Makes sense.
And it's easy to see why. Insatiable tenant demand, limited supply, and rising rents, coupled with high barriers to entry and strong customer lock-in once you're in a facility, which all translates to low risk and very stable cash flows. It's a gold rush, but one that's bottlenecked by infrastructure.
And this is where the narrative takes a truly intriguing turn on the power front. Google, one of the biggest drivers of this data center demand, is making a significant investment in Kairos Power, a a small modular reactor startup.
Nuclear power for data centers. Seriously.
Seriously, their ambitious goal: to power Google's data centers in Tennessee and Alabama with a 50-megawatt molten salt reactor by as early as 2030.
Molten salt. That sounds familiar but futuristic.
It's not entirely new technology, mind you. Its roots actually trace all the way back to the Oak Ridge National Laboratory's groundbreaking experiments in the 1950s and 60s. So a very old idea is seeing a new life.
Okay, so how do these molten salt reactors work, basically?
Well, the concept involves tiny uranium grains called TRISO fuel pellets, which are encased in carbon and ceramic. These pellets are then cooled by molten fluoride salts, which transfer the heat. Power is then generated indirectly via traditional steam turbines.
Okay, and Google isn't alone in looking at nuclear.
No, not at all. Oracle and Amazon are also actively exploring small modular reactors, or SMRs, as a potential solution to address their rapidly growing energy needs for compute. It's a sign of how desperate the industry is becoming for stable, massive power sources.
But it can't be that easy, right? There must be challenges with SMRs.
Oh, absolutely. The path to widespread adoption of SMRs isn't without its significant hurdles, and it's critical to acknowledge them. While Kairos has successfully secured Nuclear Regulatory Commission approval for its test reactors, a similar scale project, which was much further along, was entirely abandoned in 2023 due to spiraling construction costs.
Cost killed it.
Costs killed it. Furthermore, the Institute for Energy Economics and Financial Analysis has published a rather skeptical report arguing that SMRs may never be truly cost-effective, are too slow to build to address immediate energy needs, and too risky as a primary solution for the fossil fuel transition.
So a lot of skepticism remains.
Definitely.
So what does this all mean for you, whether you're a consumer of digital services or a business relying on the cloud? The insatiable demand for data centers, directly fueled by the AI boom, is exposing critical infrastructure limitations, particularly in power supply. This immense pressure is pushing for radical, potentially game-changing solutions like nuclear power, a technology that was once considered too complex or dangerous for commercial use at this scale. But the journey to practical, affordable, and widely available alternative energy sources for massive compute is clearly fraught with significant financial, logistical, and even public perception challenges.
It's not just a technical problem.
Not at all. It's not just a race against time and capacity, but also against skepticism and established grid limitations.
Indeed. And these strategic considerations about technological self-sufficiency and resource allocation also play out on an even grander scale within governments themselves as nations grapple with integrating cutting-edge technology into often slow-moving bureaucracies and increasingly as a tool of geopolitical influence.
That's a truly powerful observation. Let's zoom out to the broader geopolitical landscape, where technological leadership, especially in advanced chips and AI, has fundamentally become a high-stakes global battleground. Every nation seems to be drawing lines in the silicon.
It certainly has. Consider NVIDIA's incredibly nuanced strategy in China. Despite the ongoing stringent U.S. export controls aimed at restricting advanced chip sales, NVIDIA is reportedly planning to develop a cut-down B30A GPU specifically for the Chinese market.
A cut-down chip that's actually really powerful.
Exactly. This chip is designed to not only outperform its previous H20 accelerators, which were already detuned for the Chinese market, but it could even rival NVIDIA's own incredibly high-end H100 and H200 chips in certain workloads.
That's a remarkably bold move for a U.S. company, especially since this B30A would, by design, actually exceed existing U.S. performance cap.
Right, which means.
This means it would absolutely require explicit approval from the U.S. Commerce Department. And as part of this arrangement, NVIDIA would also have to send a 15% revenue check back to Uncle Sam for the sales.
A tech tax, essentially.
Basically. NVIDIA's public stance, by the way, is that they operate with full approval of the applicable authorities, which suggests they've already been in deep negotiations.
What's also quite interesting about the B30A is its potential dual purpose. Its single-die design and 600-watt power limit could make it a viable, high-performance PCIe replacement for the aging H200 NVL and other markets.
So hedging their bets.
Exactly. This effectively allows NVIDIA to hedge its bets against potential future shifts in U.S. trade policy or changes in Chinese demand. However, it's worth noting that Chinese demand for NVIDIA GPUs may actually be waning, at least for certain sectors, as Beijing is reportedly pressuring local cloud providers and model developers not to use NVIDIA Kit, especially for sensitive government workloads, clearly favoring domestic alternatives where possible.
That makes sense. This nationalistic drive, where countries want more control over their tech supply chains, extends beyond just cutting-edge AI chips, too.
Yeah.
AWS recently announced that they're using custom Intel's Xeon 6 processors for their new R8i and R8i Flex instance types. They're making a bold claim, too, stating these deliver the highest performance and fastest memory bandwidth among comparable Intel processors in the cloud.
Custom silicon is the name of the game for hyperscalers?
It seems to be.
Hyperscalers often run custom CPUs like this to gain a competitive edge in their cloud offerings. Oracle, for example, has also boasted about running Xeons with more cores or slightly faster chips than what's available off the shelf. This strategic move by AWS, adopting a custom Intel variant, is undoubtedly good news for Intel.
Keeps them in the game.
Exactly. It showcases their continued relevance and importance as a key customer in a cloud-dominated world, especially as AMD and ARM-based chips increasingly compete for market share.
And it's not just the U.S. and China playing this high-stakes game. The U.K., for instance, has its own national semiconductor strategy, launched in May 2023, aiming to elevate its position in the global chip industry.
Right, but they're focusing differently, aren't they?
They are. A report from the Council for Science and Technology notes that the U.K. possesses a niche and highly specialized chip industry that simply isn't positioned to compete head-to-head with giants like the U.S., Taiwan, or Korea in high-volume manufacturing.
So instead of trying to catch up in a race it can't win, the UK is strategically focusing its investment on design and R&D, particularly in the realm of compound semiconductors.
Compound semiconductors, what exactly are those?
These use different chemistries and materials like gallium nitride or silicon carbide to create chips with specific, unique properties, such as optic sensitivity or superior power management.
Okay.
These specialized chips find applications in everything from LiDAR systems for autonomous vehicles to advanced power electronics and even quantum computing. While initiatives like ChipStart and funding for innovation centers are in place to support this, Tech UK, a prominent industry body, has criticized the unfortunately slow action compared to the rapid deployment of the EU Chips Act and the US Chips Act.
So they feel the UK needs to move faster.
They emphasize the urgent need for more prototyping facilities, often called onshoring, and critically, a skilled talent pipeline.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, it's abundantly clear that technological leadership, especially in AI and chips, is no longer just an economic race. It's a fierce geopolitical battleground.
Absolutely.
Nations are increasingly prioritizing domestic capabilities, not just for economic gain, but profoundly for national security reasons. This leads to a complex, constantly shifting web of trade controls, massive government subsidies, and strategic partnerships, where every move on the tech chessboard has immense global implications for innovation, supply chains, and power dynamics.
Indeed. And these strategic considerations about technology's role in society, particularly the challenges of integrating cutting-edge innovations, also play out in the often slow-moving and incredibly complex world of government bureaucracy.
This is a classic challenge, isn't it? The U.S. federal government, for example, has been trying to standardize its IT costs and resources since 2017 with something called the Technology Business Management, or TBM, framework.
Right, TBM, trying to get a handle on IT spending.
The idea was to bring some order and transparency to their sprawling IT spending. But a recent Government Accountability Office, or GAO, report reveals that this monumental effort has largely stalled, almost 8 years in.
Stalled after 8 years.
Pretty much. The GAO is clearly frustrated with the White House Office of Management and Budget, or OMB, for failing to expand requirements beyond the initial layers of the TBM framework, and, crucially, for not providing concrete plans for its full implementation.
So, lack of guidance from the top.
Seems that way. Despite many federal agencies actually being hungry for these standards and having implemented initial portions, the complete lack of cohesive OMB guidance means there are no reliable standardized cost models or full TBM implementation plans across the vast federal enterprise.
So what's the GAO saying now?
The GAO actually issued a blunt ultimatum. The OMB needs to determine if TBM is a real priority for the current administration or, and this is a direct quote, abandon the effort entirely.
Wow, abandon it.
The Register even noted their inability to get comments from the OMB or the White House on this, which speaks volumes about the issue's sensitivity.
Yeah, radio silence isn't a great sign.
It's quite a stark contrast to what other government bodies are envisioning for technology, especially AI. The General Services Administration, or GSA, for instance, which handles procurement for the entire federal government, is actively seeking industry input on integrating AI into their procurement processes.
Okay, so the GSA is bullish on AI.
Very. Their vision is for a single, integrated, collaborative, and highly efficient procurement ecosystem, profoundly enhanced by AI. It sounds like something out of a science fiction novel, doesn't it?
Right,
especially when you consider where they are now.
It does. The draft design from the GSA outlines an ambitious future where AI is interwoven throughout the entire acquisition lifecycle management system for everything from searching, writing, planning, and assessing.
That's comprehensive.
They envision an AI chatbot for federal employees with full user context and data access, providing real-time guidance and sophisticated real-time spending analytics. This incredibly ambitious vision stems from their own brutally honest assessment of the current federal procurement system, which they openly and quite aptly describe as antiquated garbage.
Antiquated garbage. They actually said that.
They did. Strong language, but probably accurate.
And they list a truly long litany of problems that are plaguing the current system. There are no standardized processes, workloads are tracked manually, complex acquisitions are handled offline, leading to manual data entry errors, correspondence is almost entirely email-based, there are no centralized metrics for performance, and even best practices are often shared informally through third-party platforms like GitHub.
Okay, yeah. Sound like it needs an overhaul, like yesterday.
It sounds less like a modern government operation and more like a procurement nightmare from a bygone era.
Meanwhile, across the pond, the UK government is also looking to AI to tackle its own unique brand of bureaucracy.
Oh yeah, what are they doing?
They've just appointed Simon Leung as their first chief AI officer, specifically tasked with using AI to help the public decipher baffling bureaucracy.
A bureaucracy buster AI officer. Interesting title.
His role is framed as positioning the UK as a leader in unlocking AI's benefits for strong foundations and economic growth, clearly linking AI to national prosperity and citizen services.
This really raises an important question for all of us. Can AI truly cut through the thick, often ossified layers of government bureaucracy, or will it simply expose existing inefficiencies and complexities in new, perhaps even more frustrating, digital ways?
Mm-hmm. The million-dollar question.
It highlights the fundamental challenge of integrating cutting-edge technology into often slow-moving, siloed public sector operations that were frankly never designed for this kind of agility, transparency, or immediate data flow. It's a true test of technology meeting institutional inertia.
Absolutely. Transitioning from the challenges within government, let's explore the ever-evolving landscape of security, particularly the ingenuity of attackers who are constantly finding new ways to exploit vulnerabilities, often with surprising tactics that go far beyond typical software flaws.
This is truly a high-stakes cat-and-mouse game, isn't it? And sometimes the mouse does something entirely unexpected.
That's a good way to put it.
What's genuinely fascinating here is the highly unusual behavior of criminals who exploited a critical vulnerability, known as CVE-2023-46604 in Apache ActiveMQ.
Okay, ActiveMQ, what did they do?
After successfully gaining persistence on victim Linux servers, these attackers then proceeded to patch the original flaw using Java archive files.
Wait, they patched the hole they came in through? Why?
This is described as very uncommon behavior, observed rarely by Red Canary researchers, and it's a clever way to conceal their intrusion from automated vulnerability scanners and even from human security teams who might be looking for that specific initial exploit, covering their tracks, basically.
Wow. That's surprisingly considerate in a malicious way. It's an incredibly sophisticated and deceptive evasion tactic. Once inside the targeted systems, the miscreants employed a sliver implant, which is actually a legitimate pen testing tool, but one that's frequently abused by black hat hackers to modify the switch configuration, granting themselves root access.
Okay, getting root access.
Then they installed a new form of Linux malware called DripDropper. This particular malware is an encrypted, Pi installer-built ELF, executable and linkable format, that communicates with Dropbox for its command and control, making it tough to analyze due to its obfuscation and password protection.
Using Dropbox for CNC color.
DripDropper also establishes persistence by modifying cron files and SSH configurations, specifically for a games user account, which would look very out of place on a production server.
Trying to blend in, maybe. And then, after patching their entry point to cover their tracks, they deliver new payloads.
Exactly. These could be anything from insidious info stealers designed to exfiltrate sensitive data, to crippling ransomware, or even broader network access tools that allow them to spread deeper into the organization.
The truly frustrating part, from a defensive standpoint, is that this critical Apache ActiveMQ flaw was actually patched by Apache back in October 2023.
Right, so months ago.
Yet far too many systems unfortunately remain vulnerable, a stark testament to the reality that IT departments are perennially overstretched and struggle to keep up with patching cycles.
It absolutely speaks to the ongoing, never-ending challenge of patch management. Beyond that, we're seeing other incredibly clever attack vectors, such as the recent intrusion into CasinoTech outfit Bragg.
CasinoTech, okay.
They publicly admitted to a breach of a third-party CRM system that occurred via social engineering attackers literally posed as HR or IT staff using convincing pretexts to gain access.
The social engineering strikes again.
While their core gaming systems weren't touched, commonly available business contact information was stolen. This wasn't a random act. It was clearly intended to facilitate future, more targeted phishing or vishing scams against the company's employees or clients.
Setting up the next attack. And here's where the plot thickens significantly on the cybercrime front. This Bragg breach is being linked to the notorious Shiny Hunters group, which is well known for its Salesforce heists and their highly effective social engineering tactics.
Right. Shiny Hunters are big players.
But a new report suggests that Shiny Hunters, along with other prominent and dangerous groups like Scattered Spider and Lapsus, now appear to be actively collaborating in a shared Telegram hangout.
Collaborating. So like teamwork among cybercriminals.
This highly concerning development indicates that cybercrime cartels are back in fashion, signifying a worrying trend of increased organization, resource sharing, and perhaps even specialization among these notorious financially motivated criminal groups. It means potentially more sophisticated, coordinated attacks are coming.
That's not good news at all.
Not at all. Yeah. And then there's a more nuanced and potentially state-sponsored layer to all of this. Paul McCarty, head of research at Safety, made a truly interesting discovery. NPM packages, specifically Solana Pump Tests and Solana's BSDK appearing on the NPM registry, that are acting as info stealers, specifically targeting Russian cryptocurrency developers.
Targeting Russian crypto devs via NPM.
Okay. The threat actor behind these packages used a handle like CryptoHand to create an illusion of legitimacy, a common tactic to lure unsuspecting developers.
So what did these packages do?
These malicious packages function by searching for cryptocurrency tokens on infected systems and then sending that sensitive data to U.S.-linked command and control C2 servers. These C2 servers were found to expose password files, crypto exchange credentials, and highly valuable wallet files.
U.S.-linked C2 servers targeting Russians.
Interesting. What's truly fascinating about this particular discovery is McCarty's speculative theory. The combination of U.S.-linked C2 servers and the specific targeting of Russian victims could potentially suggest a state-sponsored actor trying to deter Kremlin-backed ransomware gangs or perhaps gather intelligence.
Plausible deniability, perhaps.
It's a compelling theory, even if there's no direct concrete evidence to definitively prove state sponsorship. And it certainly highlights the complex motivations and players in the global cyber landscape.
So what's the core takeaway here for you, the listener, whether you're a professional in IT or simply a user of digital services? The sophistication of cyber attackers continues to evolve at an alarming pace, from unique evasion tactics like self-patching and hiding their tracks, to the formation of actual organized criminal cartels sharing resources and intelligence.
It really reinforces the uncomfortable truth that no organization, regardless of its size, industry, or security budget, is truly immune. Vigilance, continuous patching, and a deep understanding of human vulnerabilities and social engineering vectors are more critical than ever in this ongoing battle.
That's a truly salient point, and it brings us to another critical area of modern technology, the double-edged sword of security and surveillance, especially with powerful technologies like facial recognition.
Ah, yes, FRT.
It's a constant, often uncomfortable tension between the pursuit of public safety and the safeguarding of individual privacy and rights.
Indeed. On one hand, facial recognition technology, or FRT, is widely deployed and justified based on benchmark tests, like those from NIST, the National Institute of Standards and Technology, Facial Recognition Vendor Test, FRVT, which often report incredibly high accuracy rates, sometimes reaching as high as 99.95%.
99.95 sounds pretty good.
It sounds amazing. But on the other hand, academics from Oxford have rigorously argued that this seemingly impressive real-world performance simply doesn't match up to those laboratory conditions.
Lab versus real world, big difference.
Huge difference. They point to real-world complexities like blurred or obscured images, the use of small and unrepresentative datasets for training, and a pervasive lack of demographic reflection in testing as key reasons for this disparity.
And the real-world failures stemming from this gap are stark and deeply concerning examples. We've seen the widely reported wrongful arrest of a Detroit man in 2020 due to FRT misidentification.
I remember that case.
And a similar case where a London activist was misidentified. A University of Essex study specifically on a live FRT deployment in London found a shocking statistic. Only 8 out of 42 identifications made by the system were actually accurate.
8 out of 42? That's terrible.
Terrible. Furthermore, a University of Pennsylvania study confirmed this performance degradation and noted that it disproportionately affects individuals from marginalized race and gender groups due to poor image quality being captured in diverse real-world scenarios. The inherent bias in the data used to train these systems and how they perform on different skin tones or facial structures is a serious civil rights issue.
Yet, it's crucial to acknowledge the nuance here. As the UPenn scientists themselves noted, that while FRT has flaws, its accuracy is still substantially higher than that of many traditional forensic methods, like fingerprinting, which have long been accepted in courts.
Right, so better than fingerprints, but still flawed.
This comparative statement raises a profound and often debated question. Does better necessarily mean good enough when it comes to technology that can lead directly to wrongful arrests, limit civil liberties, or perpetuate systemic biases? The bar for a technology with such wide-ranging implications should perhaps be set much higher.
Yeah, the stakes are incredibly high.
Beyond just accuracy, there are major policy and consent issues swirling around FRT. A 2023 U.S. Government Accountability Office report found that various U.S. agencies are actively using FRT without adequate training for personnel or, critically, without robust civil rights policies in place to govern its use.
So deployment without proper governance.
Exactly. The Algorithmic Justice League's Comply to Fly report, for example, highlighted that the Transportation Security Administration, or TSA, is using FRT at airports without obtaining truly informed consent from travelers.
At the airport? Wow.
The report cites instances where travelers reported hostile treatment or significant delays if they attempted to opt out of the facial scan. This paints a picture of surveillance expanding without clear guardrails, user awareness, or genuine choice.
Opting out becomes a hassle, or worse. Shifting to another privacy battleground that's making headlines, we have the UK's ongoing VPN dilemma.
Ah, yes, the Online Safety Act and VPNs.
The Children's Commissioner for England, Dame Rachel D'Souza, is currently urging the government to force VPN providers to implement highly effective age assurance mechanisms. Her aim is to prevent under-18s from bypassing the Online Safety Act's OSA age blocks, particularly for pornographic websites.
Okay, so trying to close a loophole.
This call comes after a recent survey showed that more young people are being exposed to pornography before the age of 18 compared to previous years, despite the OSA's mandatory age checks. While Pornhub UK traffic did drop 47% immediately after the law came into force, the commissioner argues that VPNs are simply being used as a workaround to circumvent these new digital fences.
The core argument, then, is that VPNs, designed for privacy and security, are being weaponized by minors to evade protective measures. However, the privacy counterargument is fiercely articulated.
Right, what's the pushback?
Graham Stewart of Checkpoint, a leading cybersecurity company, warns that any attempt to ban or hobble VPNs would risk collateral damage. He argues it would effectively force Internet Service Providers, ISP, to block legitimate encrypted traffic, which would stifle online privacy and security.
Undermining the whole point of VPNs for everyone else.
Exactly. It could also regulate an entire industry, the VPN industry, out of existence, and fundamentally legislate against cybersecurity and privacy, which are cornerstones of a free and secure internet. He also points out the real-world impact. Many schools, for example, heavily rely on VPNs for secure student access to internal systems and educational resources, so this isn't just about accessing inappropriate content.
That's a really important point. The UK government's stance for now is that VPNs are legal tools for adults, and there are no plans to outright ban them. However, they've made it clear that platforms or services found to be actively pushing workarounds to children face tough enforcement.
So, a warning shot.
This entire situation highlights the inherent tension.
Yeah.
How do we ensure public safety and protect vulnerable populations, particularly children, without disproportionately impacting broader populations or undermining fundamental digital freedoms like privacy and security for everyone? This raises a profound question. When does the pursuit of control, even for a noble cause, become a greater risk to our fundamental digital liberties than the problem it aims to solve? It's a balance society is still struggling to define.
From the complexities of security and surveillance, let's dive into some of the more everyday tech tribulations that affect millions of users, starting, unsurprisingly, with Microsoft's ongoing quality control issues, particularly with Windows updates.
Ah, Patch Tuesday woes. It's a persistent, almost annual problem, isn't it? Microsoft's August 2025 security update, released just recently, managed to break the Windows reset and recovery functionality so badly.
Broke reset and recovery. That's fundamental.
It wasn't a minor glitch. It affected not only Windows 10, which is already nearing its end of service, but also many other versions of Windows still widely in use by businesses and individuals.
So if you're a Windows 10 user, and let's be real, many of you can't even upgrade to Windows 11 due to those stringent hardware compatibility requirements, you're now facing issues with basic recovery features.
Great timing for them.
Things like reset my PC or fix problems using Windows Update could fail. Even enterprise features like remote wipe CSP, which are crucial for security, were impacted. And they also confirmed that some Windows upgrades were failing with a specific error, 0x800707F, though they said that particular issue was fixed by August 15th.
Small comfort.
It's a particularly ironic dilemma for those users stuck on Windows 10, now struggling with basic self-repair.
This is where Microsoft often earns its unofficial nickname, Patch the Patch.
It really is.
They had to release out-of-band patches on August 20th, effectively to clean up the mess created by their initial August security update. It's a reactive cycle that's all too familiar.
Feels like Groundhog Day sometimes.
Other reported problems with the initial August update included issues with Windows Server Update Services, WSUS, and significant storage problems occurring under heavy load, which can cripple business operations.
Oh, lovely.
It's almost comedic when you realize that even Microsoft's own Copilot chatbot, when asked about the situation, had to admit the August 2025 Windows security update has stirred up quite a bit of trouble across multiple versions of Windows.
The AI itself knew. That's almost too perfect, isn't it?
It really is.
It truly highlights the constant balancing act for you, the user.
Yeah.
Do you apply critical security fixes immediately and risk unexpected system borkage? Or do you hold off and potentially remain vulnerable to known threats?
Damned if you do, damned if you don't.
It underscores the ongoing, undeniable need for robust backup and recovery plans, and perhaps a healthy dose of skepticism towards mandatory updates from a major vendor known for these cycles. And on the topic of Microsoft, the Microsoft-owned Nuance, which is a company specializing in healthcare AI and speech technology, recently settled a Movadis breach lawsuit for $8.5 million. Nuance argued it wasn't negligent in the breach, but settled anyway, likely due to the extra scrutiny and significant financial risks patient data breaches incur.
Healthcare data breaches are always a bigger deal. From the everyday woes of Windows, let's shift our gaze upwards, way up, to some truly fascinating adventures in space, where cutting-edge AI, massive rockets, and even surprisingly old spacesuits are making headlines.
This is truly a global effort now. China, for instance, has integrated AI directly into its space station operations in a significant way. Taikonauts aboard China's Tiangong space station recently used an AI model called Wukong AI to prepare for a spacewalk.
Wukong AI, based on a Chinese model.
Based on a homegrown open source AI model, possibly developed by iFlyTech, a major Chinese AI company. It's specifically tailored for professional aerospace applications, meaning it speaks the language of spaceflight.
Okay, so AI mission planning.
Exactly. Wukong AI boasts a comprehensive knowledge base of flight standards, operational procedures, and safety protocols. What's remarkable is that it operates both on-premise on the space station itself and on Earth via a chat interface, allowing ground control to interact with it.
On-premise in space. That's cool.
It can produce highly detailed work schedules for spacewalks and provide relevant links and guidance to the Taikonauts as they prepare. And crucially, this system is running on a cloud powered by homegrown Loongson CPUs, which China launched to the space station just last year, highlighting their drive for technological independence in space.
Makes sense. And speaking of long-term use and remarkable resilience, that spacewalk actually marked the 20th use of a single spacesuit.
20 uses for one suit.
This particular suit was originally designed for only 15 missions. It has truly gone above and beyond, having been used by 11 different Taikonauts.
Talk about getting your money's worth.
While impressive from a durability standpoint, it's probably a relief that two new, longer lifespan suits have thankfully just arrived on the station, ensuring continued safety for future spacewalks.
Probably time for an upgrade. The U.S. is also heavily invested in leveraging AI for space exploration, right? Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. The AI Space Cortex Project, a cutting-edge collaboration between Caltech, NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory, and UCLA, is exploring highly autonomous operations for future incredibly ambitious space missions, such as the Europa Lander, which will search for life on Jupiter's icy moon.
Europa Lander. Wow.
The system is designed with incredible capabilities. It integrates hierarchical control for complex tasks, active vision for real-time environmental understanding, real-time telemetry processing, and the ability to self-diagnose and recalibrate, all powered by sophisticated computer vision and large language models, specifically OpenAI's GPT-4o via API.
Self-diagnosing robots in space. That's pretty sci-fi.
What's truly remarkable here and offers a glimpse into the future of robotics in space is an anecdote shared by Thomas Tuma, a robotics research scientist at Caltech. He talked about how the AI Space Cortex system could recalibrate a damaged robot arm to over 90% accuracy using only the camera for feedback.
Using vision to fix itself. Incredible.
Imagine a robot arm getting damaged millions of miles away, and an AI can use its vision to figure out how to compensate and continue its mission. Tuma suggested this capability could potentially save hundreds of millions, maybe $1 billion, if something goes wrong on a mission that far out.
Huge cost savings potential.
And importantly, Tuma also noted that the system was quite lucid and didn't exhibit hallucinations commonly associated with LLMs due to careful system boundaries and hard stops designed for critical space applications.
So reliable enough for space. That's a huge vote of confidence for AI in high-stakes environments.
Definitely. Meanwhile, back on Earth, NASA is beginning the assembly of the Gargantuan Space Launch System, or SLS, rocket for the Artemis III lunar landing mission.
Artemis III, the next moon landing.
This mission is targeting the lunar South Pole, aiming for a 2027 landing. However, there are plenty of significant ifs and buts surrounding this mission, including the very real possibility of Artemis III being the final SLS flight due to ongoing budget proposals and shifts in long-term strategy.
The final SLS flight.
It's a possibility being discussed.
And a major uncertainty, which cannot be overstated, is NASA's profound reliance on SpaceX's Starship human landing system to actually get the astronauts down to the lunar surface.
Right. Starship needs to work reliably.
SpaceX has been under immense pressure, as its last three Starship test flights haven't exactly gone smoothly, with the most recent one suffering an energetic event and exploding before even leaving Earth's atmosphere. The pressure's on for them to prove Starship's reliability.
Speaking of SpaceX, they're gearing up for their 10th Starship flight test, currently scheduled for August 24th. They've also provided highly detailed analysis of the energetic events that occurred during the 9th flight.
Okay, what went wrong on Flight 9?
The booster, for instance, was lost due to a higher angle of attack experiment that unfortunately caused structural loads beyond the fuel transfer tube's capability, leading to its breakup.
Pushing the envelope too far.
Seems like it. The upper stage was lost due to leaks that led to an off-nominal attitude, essentially. It lost control and resulted in skipped payload deployment and engine relights, likely from a main fuel tank pressurization diffuser failure.
Multiple issues, then.
And if that wasn't enough, there was also a pad explosion caused by a composite overwrapped pressure vessel, or COPV, fault. SpaceX plans to address this by updating inspection criteria and operating the vessels at lower pressures to prevent a recurrence.
Lots of lessons learned, hopefully.
What's truly fascinating here is the growing reliance on AI for increasingly complex autonomous operations in space, balancing cutting-edge innovation with the incredibly harsh realities of rocket science, the immense financial stakes, and the inherent risks of pushing the boundaries of what's possible in space.
It's a testament to human ambition and ingenuity. And we should note, only two flights remain with the current Starship generation before a significant redesign.
That's right. High stakes for these next couple of flights. From the cutting edge of space exploration and its associated challenges, let's take a moment to appreciate some retro computing and then dive into a fascinating deep discussion about operating system philosophy, starting with a true classic celebrating a big anniversary.
That's right. The iconic Commodore Amiga is now 40 years old, believe it or not.
40 years. Wow.
And the National Museum of Computing in the UK is celebrating this milestone with the fantastic hands-on exhibition. You can get up close and personal with beloved models like the Amiga 500, though some of the rarer ones, like the Amiga 1000, are strictly look and don't touch. It's a real trip down memory lane for many.
I bet. The exhibition offers a unique insight into the challenges of preserving aging hardware like the Amiga. Volunteers like Alex Vinol have their hands full dealing with plastics that have yellowed over decades. They prefer light restoration over harsh retrograding techniques, which can sometimes damage the plastic.
Right, gotta be careful with the classics.
They also perform rigorous electrical safety checks on all the old machines. A major bane for retro computing enthusiasts, as Vinol explained, are REFA capacitors, which are notorious for cracking and posing smoke or even fire risks.
The exploding REFA caps. A legend.
And of course, the infamous leaking batteries that can spill corrosive chemicals directly onto irreplaceable motherboards, causing irreversible damage.
Nightmare fuel for collectors. Some machines are particularly tricky to maintain, right?
Yeah, the Amiga 600 and 1200, for instance, have surface mount capacitors that can look perfectly innocent on the outside, but they often hide severe corrosion underneath, requiring incredibly delicate desoldering work to save the machine.
Delicate work indeed. But what's truly fascinating, perhaps even profound, is an observation from one of the museum's volunteers. While classic games like Paperboy and Star Wars were popular with visitors,
sure, the hits.
Younger generations, who had never seen an Amiga before, were surprisingly drawn to an old application called Deluxe Paint 3. They weren't playing games, they were simply using it for sketching.
Deluxe Paint, wow, just creating stuff.
Just creating. This led the volunteer to a very provocative thought, a powerful message from the past that still resonates today. Perhaps simplicity is the key.
Interesting.
They muse that it's a valuable lesson for today's software vendors, who often obsess over loading up simple text and bitmap editors with AI, when all users want is simplicity.
Oof, that's a direct hit on current trends. It's a profound commentary on the current trend of over-engineering and feature bloat, reminding us that sometimes the most elegant design is the one that simply does its job beautifully and without unnecessary complexity.
Well said. And speaking of operating system history and fundamental design choices, let's acknowledge the recent release of Debian Junior Herd 2025.
The Herd. Still going.
This is the latest version of what's often called the other GNU operating system, and it's built on the Mach microkernel, which is actually also the foundation used in Apple's Mac OS and iOS. It's been a long journey for this project, often overlooked by the mainstream.
Its significance lies in its persistent progress despite being a niche project. This new version features a truly working by 8664 edition, supports USB and CD drives, has a Rust language port, and even features quite working symmetric multiprocessing or SMP support, meaning it can take advantage of multiple CPU cores.
So making real progress.
Yeah, and it's also capable of running about 72% of the Debian archive, which is a significant step for an experimental OS. While it's still highly experimental and certainly not a Windows replacement for general users, it won't run most existing proprietary software. It continues the legacy of an ambitious, decades-old design.
This brings us to the core concept of microkernels versus monolithic kernels, a fundamental philosophical divide in operating system design. Can you break that down simply?
Sure. So in a microkernel, most of the operating system code runs in user space as separate, small modules that communicate with each other through a tightly controlled core. Think small, independent parts talking. This is contrasted with monolithic kernels, like Linux, where the entire OS is essentially one giant, tightly integrated program running in privilege mode. Think one big, complex machine.
Got it. And microkernels had performance issues historically.
Exactly. Historically, microkernels faced a significant performance burden due to the constant inter-process communication required between all those separate modules, which is why monolithic kernels largely came to dominate for general-purpose desktops and servers. Faster, but maybe less robust.
Okay, so monolithic won the desktop server war, mostly, but microkernels aren't dead.
Not at all. And here's the truly surprising part. Despite microkernels not being dominant on desktops, they are, in fact, incredibly commercially successful and widely used, often quietly doing their job behind the scenes.
Like where?
BlackBerry's QNX, for instance, is a commercially successful microkernel that powers everything from car infotainment systems to nuclear power plants.
QNX, right, I've heard of that.
And Minix 3, whose creator, Dr. Andy Tenenbaum, won a prestigious award for it last year, famously runs deep inside the management processor of every single Intel processor since about 2008, a critical, often unseen layer of security and management.
Minix is inside Intel chips.
Wow. Billions of them. The L4 microkernel has also shipped in billions of instances in embedded systems worldwide. These microkernels quietly do their jobs without fuss in critical embedded systems and other foundational roles, proving their value beyond the desktop.
It truly challenges the idea that success always looks like a dominant desktop operating system. This segment is a journey through computing history and philosophy, highlighting the enduring power and quiet successes of elegant design principles, even if they aren't always the most pragmatic path to initial widespread adoption. It also raises an important speculative question for the future. What happens to the massive Linux kernel, now nearly 40 million lines of code, when its creator, Linus Torvalds, eventually retires? Will its sheer size and complexity push the community to reconsider more modular approaches, perhaps even drawing inspiration from these foundational microkernel concepts?
It's a valid question. The complexity is immense.
Finally, let's turn our attention to Python, a programming language that has seen truly explosive growth in popularity and application across almost every sector of technology.
Python's everywhere now.
Yet its foundational organization faces incredibly significant financial hurdles. It's a fascinating paradox.
It truly is. The 8th Python Developer Survey, which was the biggest in scope yet with over 30,000 contributors, indicates strong indications of growth that are almost unprecedented for a language of its age.
Like how much growth?
We're talking about a 7% increase in usage according to Stack Overflow's own metrics, and a truly huge influx of new developers. The survey found that 50% of Python developers have less than 2 years of professional coding experience.
Half of them.
And a staggering 39% of all Python users started learning the language in the last 2 years alone. That's an incredible adoption rate.
Despite this surge in adoption and widespread use, the survey found that only about 15% of developers actually use the very latest Python version 3.13, while 3.12 and 3.1 are most widely used.
I'm still lagging a bit on the latest versions.
PSF fellow Michael Kennedy, who is a prominent figure in the Python community, claims that a full upgrade by all users to the latest, most efficient versions could potentially save millions of dollars in cloud usage bills due to significant performance improvements in recent releases.
Millions in savings just by upgrading Python.
That's the claim. And given that most developers are now using containers or serverless functions, upgrading should, in theory, be relatively easy. However, developers cite common reasons for not upgrading. Simply meeting their immediate needs, potential compatibility issues with older libraries, and, of course, the ever-present lack of time.
The usual suspects. Python's omnipresence is undeniable, though. While data analysis stands at 48% of its usage, and when you combine that with machine learning at 41% and data engineering at 31%, data science clearly dominates Python's overall usage profile.
Data science is king.
But web development is also incredibly strong, accounting for 46% of its usage and rising. This demonstrates the language's incredible versatility across the most in-demand tech domains.
In terms of web frameworks, Django and Flask, two very different but equally powerful options, are nearly equally popular.
The old guard's still strong.
Meanwhile, FastAPI, which is much newer, has seen a sharp rise in usage, reflecting its appeal for building modern high-performance APIs. And there's a fascinating new, rapidly growing Rust-based tool called Uve.
Uve, yeah, I've heard about that. Built in Rust.
Which is positioned as a faster, we're talking 10 to 100 times faster, and more comprehensive replacement for pip, the standard Python package installer, is already at 11% usage, which is remarkable for such a new tool.
11% already? That's fast adoption.
Even the IDE landscape is shifting, with Microsoft's Visual Studio Code increasing its lead over JetBrains PyCharm as the preferred choice for Python development.
VS Code taking over everywhere. Here's what's truly unsettling, though. Despite Python's surging usage and undeniable dominance across so many tech sectors, enabling massive value creation for corporations worldwide, the Python Software Foundation, or PFF, is currently facing a severe existential funding crisis.
A funding crisis? With Python being so popular.
Exactly. They've actually had to pause their grants program entirely due to a lack of funds, a situation driven by the rising costs of foundational events like PyCon US and the general operational expenses of running a global nonprofit foundation.
Paused grants. That's serious. The numbers are stark and clearly illustrate the severity of the situation. The PSF reported a negative net income of -$1,462,000 in 2024.
Over $1 million in the red.
That's a significant worsening from an already concerning $225,000 in 2023. It's a steep decline. For those unfamiliar, the PSF plays an absolutely critical, almost unseen role in the Python ecosystem. They host PyPI, which is the central repository for all Python packages. They distribute Python itself, they run those crucial community events, and they employ the core CPython developers who maintain the language.
They do the essential plumbing, basically.
Without their tireless work, much of what Python developers and the companies that profit from them rely on simply wouldn't exist or function.
So their message is clear and direct. The PSF needs more support and resources from the corporations that are built on and making revenue from Python. It's a direct appeal for the very entities benefiting most from this open source powerhouse to contribute to its long-term sustainability.
So what does this all mean for you as a developer, a business leader, or simply as someone who benefits daily from open source software? This highlights the profound and often unaddressed paradox of open source success.
Yeah, success doesn't always pay the bills.
Widespread adoption of a project like Python creates immense value and wealth for corporations, from tech giants to small startups. But the funding models for the foundational organizations that maintain these vital projects often struggle to keep pace with that success. They rely on voluntary contributions from the very corporations that profit most, yet those contributions are frequently insufficient to cover the escalating costs of maintenance, infrastructure, and development.
It raises a truly important and complex question for the entire digital ecosystem. How do we ensure the long-term sustainability of these vital foundational open source projects when their success and economic impact aren't directly or proportionately tied to their creators' or maintainers' financial well-being? It's a challenge that affects every line of code, every application, and every digital service we use.
And that brings us to the end of our deep dive into the Register RSS Feeds Morning Edition for Wednesday, August 20th, 2025. From AI's unexpected costs and the deep privacy pitfalls to the immense power demands of data centers and the geopolitical chess game of chip manufacturing. And from the quiet foundational tech humming beneath the surface of our digital world to the very real funding challenges facing our most popular open source projects, we've covered a vast and interconnected landscape today.
Indeed. We've seen just how quickly technology evolves, how seemingly disparate topics can be profoundly interconnected, and the undeniable human element, for better or worse, always remains central to how these technologies are built, deployed, and ultimately impact us.
Definitely.
Our deep dive today into your sources underscores that being truly well-informed means understanding not just the what, but the why, and most crucially, the so what, for your own life and work.
Absolutely. And as we consider everything we've discussed today, especially the challenges around balancing rapid innovation with ethical oversight, unexpected costs, and critical security concerns that permeate every layer of our digital infrastructure, here's a thought for you to mull over. As AI becomes increasingly interwoven into the very fabric of our lives and critical infrastructure, blurring the lines between creation, deployment, and usage, who ultimately bears the primary responsibility for its unintended consequences, the creators of the AI models, the companies who deploy and profit from them, or us, the users who rely on their convenience?
It's a complex question, one that will undoubtedly continue to shape the tech landscape for years to come. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for joining us on the Deep Dive.
Yeah.
We look forward to our next exploration together.